Well, good morning. Welcome to Living Water here this morning. As I was preparing for the message, I'm like, I really don't know how pastors always start their message. So I guess that's my introduction, is just welcome. And also, I had a nephew very concerned how long this was going to go. So you can figure out which one that was, and hopefully we keep this moving and it doesn't take too long. This morning, what I'm going to do is there is different situations, many different accounts in the Bible that God gives us. I think it's very easy for us growing up in church. We study these stories growing up. We know all the numbers. We know the accounts. And it's very easy for us to not think of how that may have looked to the people actually living those accounts out. So I have four different accounts that we'll be looking at this morning and trying to maybe take a moment to jump into their shoes, see what that might have looked like, and then what God maybe was teaching them or can teach us through those accounts. I enjoy numbers. Numbers are fun to me. Multiplication, division, addition, subtraction, all wonderful things. So most of these accounts will involve numbers and maybe what that looked like to those people there. So starting off, we will start off in 2 Chronicles chapter 6. This is the account of Solomon dedicating the temple to the Lord. And this account here, I taught this account in whatever class is right under intermediate upstairs several years ago. We looked at it. We were filling in the lesson. You know, they always had the questions at the end that we were filling in from the lesson. And I went home and I was like, man, that looked different than I thought. And I hadn't even before the lesson, hadn't even caught it. That's maybe how much I studied for the lesson. I'm not sure. But I went home and started doing math, and I'm like, well, that's a lot. That's a lot. That's a lot. So we'll look at how many a lot is in this account. And ever since then, I've just kind of been, as I read through the Bible in different accounts, been noticing that as we go. So the parallel account to this is in 1 Kings chapter 8 and 9. We will not be looking at 1 Kings 8 and 9. There is some information in there that is not in ours that is I might reference as we go. So they build a temple. King Solomon has a big celebration. Everyone comes. He actually builds a platform up high so that when he climbs up there to kneel before the Lord and dedicate the temple, he kneels down, he raises his hands, and he prays a long prayer that is 30, 40 verses long, depending on which account you're looking at. Very long prayer talking about God's faithfulness in building the temple, how he has delivered them, thanks for answered prayers, things like that. And then if we go to 2 Chronicles, chapter 7, verses 1 through 8 is what I want to read, and then we want to look at that a little bit. Now when Solomon had made an end of praying, and the fire came down from heaven, and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the house, and the priests could not enter into the house of the Lord because of the glory of the Lord, and had filled the Lord's house. And when all the children of Israel saw the fire came down, and the glory of the Lord came upon the house, they bowed themselves with their faces to the ground upon the pavement, and worshipped and praised the Lord, saying, "For he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." And then this next little part of my Bible is labeled the sacrifice and rejoicing. And so realize this is just one huge celebration. And in a huge celebration of God, what did they do? And that's what we want to look at here, the next several verses. And the king and all the people offered sacrifices before the Lord. And King Solomon offered a sacrifice of 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. So the king and all the people dedicated the house of the Lord. And the priests waited on their offices, and the Levites also with instruments of music of the Lord, which David the king had made to praise the Lord, because his mercy endureth forever, when David praised by their ministry, and the priests sounded trumpets before them, and all of Israel stood. Moreover, Solomon hallowed the middle of the court that was before the house of the Lord, for there he offered burnt offerings and the fat of the peace offerings, because the brazen altar which Solomon had made was not able to receive the burnt offerings, the meat offerings, and the fat. And also at the same time, Solomon kept the feast 7 days and all of Israel with him, a very great congregation from the entering in of Hamath unto the river of Egypt. A lot of people, 7 day festival celebration. And in this 7 days, as it tells us in verse 5, they offered 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. So what does that look like? 22,000 oxen. We'll start off with 22,000 oxen. And I Googled things, so those of you farmers that are going to say this is way off, talk to Google, I guess. I don't know. They said the average oxen is 6.5 feet long. All right, so if we go 22,000 oxen, if we start a line of oxen right here at the front of the church. Head south, get over to State Road 15, head south on 15. We're going past US 6, past Milford, past Leesburg, through Warsaw, and south of Warsaw, 3 to 4 miles in a single line of oxen to sacrifice. All right, so that's their oxen. The sheep are 120,000 sheep. Once again, per Google, 4.2 feet is the average sheep length. Now, I don't know what kind of sheep that is. I don't know, but we're going to use the number 4.2. So if we take that times 120,000, we'll head north this time. We'll go up US 33, up State Road 15, hit the toll road, head west, and we're almost to the state line by the time we get to the end of the sheep. So a lot of sheep, a lot of oxen. Another way of thinking of the sheep here is if we'd put Hunter in a lawn chair out front, and a sheep goes by every second, he would be there from now until 8:23 tomorrow night. All right, so there's a lot of sheep and a lot of oxen that are going to be a part of this celebration. And as we go through this, just be thinking of what maybe these people were thinking with this. Massive amounts of animals. Once again, we can sheep really pack together in a flock. So if we go 4 feet for the sheep, 1 foot wide, these are skinny sheep, I guess. That's 4 square feet. Oxen, we're going 6.5 feet long by 1.5 feet wide. You'd be getting pretty close to 20 acres of animals. All right, so the church property here, I believe, is 6 acres. So roughly 3 times this, if all these animals are all packed together in one huge herd slash flock of animals. Another way of thinking about this, 142,000 animals total, and they tell us that the feast is kept for 7 days, and so they, if we think of just sacrificing these animals, if you would do sacrifices 12 hours a day for 7 days, 28 men would need to kill an animal every minute for 12 hours for 7 days to sacrifice all these animals. It comes out to just over 20,000 animals per day that they need to kill and then to sacrifice. Some commentaries were talking about the fact of, obviously the blood is a huge thing. If you just get a gallon of blood from each animal you kill, that's 20,000 gallons of blood every day running somewhere. I don't know, wherever they killed them, that's where it was going. And they were also talking about the massive amounts. How do you sacrifice that many animals? Like in burnt offerings, how do you do that? How big a fire do you have that you are trying to sacrifice these animals? Which I don't have a good answer for that. Just thinking about the amount of blood, which is kind of where I wanted to go with this account, and how these people probably walking away from that celebration and that dedication had an appreciation of the blood and the significance of the blood. And how many, Arden or Steve or someone, how many gallons does a milk truck hold that comes and gets milk? Ballpark, how many gallons? All right. Excellent. Google's not too bad. Google said 7 to 8, but I had no idea if they knew what they were talking about or not. So if you just think of the fact of a gallon from each animal that they sacrifice today, and I think that's probably low, you're talking 3 to 4 milk trucks full blood that is being dumped out somewhere as they sacrifice that. And I had to think, if you're going home with your family from this festival and you're talking about, hey, we have a temple where we can now go and worship the Lord and we can go take our sacrifices there, and that's where we go to have a relationship with God. Going home from that celebration, the thing I would be thinking about is there's a lot of blood that it takes to be right with God and to come into his presence and to worship him, the importance of blood. And I think sometimes that's lost to us because we know Jesus and his blood takes care of all of that, obviously. And yet to the Jewish people that lived at the time of Christ when they transitioned, I'm sure that Jesus' blood maybe carried more significance than what we think of sometimes with that. So that's the first account I want us to look at and just be thinking about the blood that it took for those people to come into God's presence and things like that. If you're interested, side note, we have time. Side note, there's a time that the Israelites defeated the Midianites in Numbers 31. And in that, they came back then with the spoils of war. And this is just a side note for a minute, just to think about it, right? And they came back. The people that fought came back. They divided the goods with the people that stayed behind. And some of it went to the temple, and some of it went to the priests and things like that. But in that account, it says there were 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, and 61,000 donkeys that came back with them. And so that would have made a line of animals from here to New York City or from here to Atlanta, Georgia, whichever you prefer. But either way, sometimes those numbers are just crazy and kind of fun to look. I enjoy looking at them. I don't know if you do, but I enjoy looking at those and thinking of the way that God provided for those people. So the next account I want us to look at is found in Numbers 11, also God providing for his people. A very familiar, somewhat familiar account that I've always wondered what this looked like. It's God with quail. The children of Israel complaining, and God sends quail. And as you read the account, there is obviously more than a few quail. So I want to look at this and look through this. And then there's also, I also want to look at the end of this, Jesus feeding the 5,000. And then we're going to compare and contrast some people's attitudes and things like that throughout the accounts. So Numbers 11 starts off 1 through 3. The people were complaining. The fire of the war came and burned among the people, which it would seem like that would be a good idea to not complain after that happens. But in verse 4, they are already complaining again because they do not have meat. And I want to point out verse 6 specifically. They are complaining, and this is the people talking, "But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes." Basically telling God, all we got is what you provided. That's all we got. And that's obviously a horrible attitude and a slap in God's face to a point that they disregarded what he had provided. Moses, verses 10 through 15, gets rather upset, does not enjoy it, does not handle it well, asks God that he would die, some things like that, like he did at times. Then we have the 70 elders in here, and I'm trying to summarize because I don't want to read just tons of this, but then starting in verse 18, we have God speaking to Moses and telling Moses, this is what you need to go and share with the people. And say thou unto the people, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, and ye shall eat flesh. For ye have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, who shall give us flesh to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you flesh, and ye shall eat. Ye shall not eat one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, neither 10 days, nor 20 days, but even a whole month, until it come out at your nostrils, and it be loathsome unto you, because that ye have despised the Lord which is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why came we forth out of Egypt? I can't help but picture a parent, the times that their children complain about things, and sometimes you just want to give them so much of it that maybe they realize they don't want that. And I think that's kind of what God's doing here. And then Moses, with his response, starting in verse 21, Moses said, the people among whom I am, are 600,000 footmen, and thou hast said, I will give them flesh that they may eat a whole month. Shall the flocks and the herds be slain for them to suffice them, or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to suffice them? Where are we going to get this meat? How's this going to happen? And the Lord said unto Moses, is the Lord's hand waxed short? Thou shalt see now whether my word shall come to pass unto thee or not. Then Moses goes out, tells the people, the Spirit of the Lord falls on several of the elders, and they prophesy and things like that. I don't really want to spend a lot of time with that. We'll jump to verse 31 through 33, when the quail come. So verse 31, and there went forth a wind from the Lord, and brought quails from the sea, and let them fall by the camp, as it were a day's journey on this side, as it were a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp, and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. And the people stood up all that day, and all that night, and all the next day, and they gathered the quails, and he that gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a very great plague. So here comes the quail, lots of quail. It starts off saying in verse 31 there, that a day's journey on each side of the camp. And so if we're just going to use the idea that the average human, when they're walking, walks between 2 and 3 miles per hour, all right? We'll use a low figure of 2 miles per hour times 8 hours in a day is 16 miles that you can walk in a day, and that's generally thought of between 15 and 20 miles is generally thought of as a day's journey. So thinking of that, if you use the Goshen Courthouse, if you go a day's journey as they say, south. That'll be somewhere down between Milford and Leesburg. If you go east from the courthouse, and it is kind of hard to get as the crow flies. Google Maps is not good as the crow flies, but we tried to get at least close here. If you go east from the courthouse, that would be approximately State Road 5 over there that goes through Shipshawana. If you go north, a few miles into Michigan. If you go west, it's over there past Dave's a couple miles short of 331 South. So you got to understand these quail are flying in this massive flock. I don't know what you call a bunch of quail. But in this massive flock, that much area that they are covering. Now, it says that they covered the ground, as it were, 2 cubits high. 2 cubits is 3 feet. Now, if you're going to take the thought that those are actually dead quail, 3 feet high on that amount of land, that's a lot of quail. a lot of commentaries would say they think that simply means that that's the height the quail were flying, that God made these quail to fly 3-4 feet off the ground so that they would be easy for the people to kill. All right, so that's maybe where that is. I know I'd read that before when I was younger, and I was like, wow, like, quail 3 feet deep, how are you even getting anywhere? You can't even walk. You got a shovel. I don't know what you do. But the thought there maybe is more that's the height they were flying. Several thoughts. There is a decent amount of commentators that would look at this and say this is just a massive exaggeration to prove a point. So I don't want to discredit that. They spent a lot more time studying this than what I did. There are a lot of fairly specific numbers in here that I think it's at least possible that God did exactly as it says, but there is also possible that maybe as people look back on the account, it even seemed bigger than what it was. I don't know. I don't want to say one way or the other. The other thing to think about that one of them brought out is that when we start talking about gathering, in verse 32, it says, he that gathered least gathered 10 homers. So it doesn't say that every man gathered, because we do have back in verse 21 where it says there's 600,000 men, all right? So they just brought out the point that that does not mean not all 600,000 were probably gathering. Some were killing, some were gathering, etc. All right, so looking at this just a little bit, a homer is equal to 6.32 bushels. So the least that any man that gathered was, wow, that's hard to say. Anyone that gathered the least of that was 63 bushels, all right, which is kind of hard to think about. The one guy, if you go on Google and Google this, there's one guy that spent an awful lot of time doing lots of calculations with this, density of birds and everything. But he did all of that, and he came out to, this basically is about a pickup truck bed full rounding of quail. And so the person that gathered the least had about a pickup truck load of quail that they had gathered with that. And just notice, I'm like, that seems a little bit crazy to me, but as it does say in verse 32, that they are gathering all day, all through the night, and all the next day. Much like hunters sat out front for a long time, these people were out gathering for an awfully long time to get quail. At what point should have they been thinking, I think I got enough quail? I would say it's before you have a truckload at some point. I don't know how they even thought they were going to consume all of that. All right? The quail were fairly small. The quail over there, this guy that did all the research said the type of quails are only 6 to 7 inches and 4 to 6 ounces in weight. He would have also brought out that if every man would have gathered, and every one of them would have gathered 63 bushels, according to his calculations, you could have went around the earth 5 times with the quail nose to tail. So it was a lot of quail, which is why he thought maybe not every man gathered. Some were killing and some were gathering and things like that. So I'm going to now transition to looking at Jesus feeding the 5,000. But I want us to think about the attitude of the people where they were complaining. They were desperate for quail. They said, man is not enough. I want quail. Give me quail. And so God gave them quail, and he gave them a lot of quail, way more than what they ever needed. And I want us to look at the feeding of the 5,000. And then we're going to do a little bit of comparing back and forth. And so for the feeding of the 5,000, I'm going to be using the account in Matthew 14. This is found in all four of the Gospels. I almost called them apostles. That would have been a mistake. all four of the Gospels. And so I'm just going to read this account here, and then I'll bring out a little bit what some of the others say about it without necessarily reading all of them. And chapter 14 starts off with John the Baptist is beheaded. And then verse 13 here, and when Jesus heard of John the Baptist being beheaded, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. And when the people had heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them and healed their sick. So Jesus withdrew, people followed him, and he took the opportunity to heal them, teach them, and things like that. And when it was evening, the disciples came to him, saying, "This is a desert place, and the time is now past. Send the multitude away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals." And Jesus said unto them, "They need not depart. Give ye them to eat." And they said unto him, "We have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And he said, "Bring them hither to me." And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass, and took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. And looking up to heaven, he blessed and brake and gave the loaves to his disciples, and the disciples to the multitude. And they did eat and were filled, and they took up of the fragments that remained 12 baskets full. And they that had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. All right, so just drawing from the other accounts here really quick to make sure we include everything maybe that is important. Both Mark and John, a disciple references 200 pennyworth. Do we need to go spend 200 pennyworth to feed these people? And a pennyworth was about a day's wage. So the disciples were asking, should we go spend 200 days' wages in order to feed this group of people? So it's a large crowd of people. Mark and Luke would both reference Jesus giving the command for them to sit in groups of 50 or 100. So they were dividing these people up into groups, fairly large groups, but dividing them up as well. And the interesting thing to me is I studied all of these different accounts of this situation. Is every single one of them was very, very specific with Jesus taking it, looking up to heaven, praying, blessing it, however they wanted to say it, and then the miracle happened, which I thought was interesting that stuck with all four of the writers, his prayer. I'm sure it would have been a very interesting prayer to hear Jesus pray. In all four accounts, either the disciples or Jesus mentioned that the crowd is getting hungry. There is no reference anywhere that the people complained or that the people asked for food, or that the people mentioned, "Hey, we got to leave to go eat." There is none of that ever mentioned. It was 3 of the accounts. It was the disciples. One of the accounts, it sounds like Jesus maybe would have mentioned that. All right, so let's look a little bit at what this looks like maybe. 5,000 men, as it says. Realize that in Jewish culture, men are from 12 and up, so it's not necessarily 20 and up. So from 12 and up, and then there was obviously women and children there as well. You can start playing with numbers and have 15, 20, 10, 1,000. There's lots of different numbers you can use. For what we're looking at today, I'm just going to use the number 10,000 just for easy figuring. I think that's probably on the low side, but I'd rather be that way than the high side just so we don't exaggerate or anything like that. So thinking of that, 10,000 people, and then it talks about the disciples serving these people. So there was the 12 disciples, and there was other people that were helping. But for the sake of thinking this through, we're just going to take the 10,000 people, and we're going to divide it by 12. So each disciple of the 12 disciples was responsible for approximately 830 people that he needed to get food to. All right. Now, Val, what was our attendance today? You're our counter. Do you know what it was? 137. Hey, that's close. 140 is what I wrote down. So 140 times 6 gives us 840. So as one disciple, Peter is here, he would need to feed 6 times this crowd by himself, him and his helpers, if we're just doing the numbers, all right, thinking that through. Now, as we think this through, we got loaves and fishes, not loaves. They didn't send huge loaves. What mom would send big loaves with their 5 of them with their child? Not what they're doing, just little loaves probably, and fish. So just thinking that through, if I was feeding this church here, you guys, I would think probably what, 3 baskets? A basket, I don't know how big a basket was, but maybe 3 baskets of the loaves and 2 of the fish would feed us. Does that sound close? Does anyone want to propose a different number, or can we roll with mine? All right, we'll roll with mine. Someone, if you want to do math differently, you can, that's fine. So we're thinking there's 5 baskets to feed you guys times 6. That means I'm responsible to get 30 baskets out to people. I think it is interesting to think about the fact then that after you all ate, I would then go out and pick up one basket of leftovers. That's all I would pick up because each of the other disciples was getting their own from that group. So we fed 850 people, and we had one basket of leftovers. That's not very much. That's really not very much. When I don't know, growing up, I just always thought 12 baskets, and you see the storybooks where they have these huge baskets in this big pile, and there's just like, looks like a lot of food left over, though it's really not when you consider the amount of people that were fed. And I think it's a good picture of everyone had enough because everyone ate and everyone was filled and there was leftovers, so you can't say that they were short, and yet there wasn't a lot of waste or way extra provided. So let's compare this a little bit with the account of the quail and the people's attitude there. There is no record of any of these 5,000 people backing up the truck and filling their truck bed full of leftovers or filling their pockets or anything like that. It's just simply they ate what God gave them, and they were satisfied, and they had what they needed. Comparing it to the people with the quail situation, they definitely had an idea of what they thought they deserved. And I just had to, as I was thinking this through when I was studying, and I don't know that I can explain it well, but just the attitude that they had with God, we deserve quail, you need to give us quail, and we demand that you give us quail. You have to. This pretty much was their attitude. Otherwise, we might as well go back to Egypt. And oftentimes we get caught in the trap of thinking there are things that we deserve or that God has to give us because that is our right, and that is a false thing to think. I had to think of the servant girl this morning in our Sunday school lesson with Naaman. She could have had a lot of things that she thought she deserved or that God should have gave her. At the very least, she could have easily said, well, Naaman deserves leprosy, so ha, there that goes. But God puts us in situations at times where we have a chance to bring glory to him by what we sacrifice and what we're content with and what we're happy with. Sometimes we think things are so important that we hold on to those desperately. And I think sometimes even God gives us so much of something that he wants us to get sick of it. And I think that's something I had to think about while studying. In America, we get pretty used to security, to comfort, to wealth, to things like that. And is there a point where God gives us so much of that that he wants us to get sick of it and say, you know what? My contentment, my happiness, my fulfillment isn't based on this security or this comfort or this safeness or this wealth, but instead it's based on God. And so hopefully that is the attitude that we have. Hopefully we don't have the attitude of those people in verse 6 when they said, God, I need quail. I have to have it, and what you gave me, manna, does not satisfy. I need more than that. We would never say that out loud. I hope we would never say that out loud, but sometimes it's easy to have that attitude. And then the last account that I want to look at today is in Judges chapter 7 with Gideon with the Midianites. Gideon and his army. Judges chapter 7. Before we get started with this, I just want you to think briefly. When you picture these 300 men surrounding the Midianite army, how far apart do you think these men were from each other if they were all equally spaced? Just think about that. Yeah, think about that as we go through that, and at the end, I will have kind of an answer, maybe possibly. We'll do some math with it and see what we can find out. So Judges chapter 7, very familiar account. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading this account. I just want us to be refreshed on a few of these things. So Judges chapter 7, verse 2, God gives Gideon the reason that we're going to reduce the amount of people. The people that are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. So they started off at like 4-1 odds. You can see that it is possible if people, you pull off this great victory, that they would have said, yeah, we did that. I mean, we were down 4-1, outnumbered 4-1, and yet we pulled this off. So God wanted to reduce that. He goes from 32,000 to 22,000. I'm sorry, 22,000 were scared and went home, 10,000 left, and then they got all the way down to 300 men, as we're very familiar with. Verse 12 in chapter 7 is talking about the Midianites, and it says, and the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seaside for multitude. So at that point, they don't even give us the number of people or the number of camels or anything like that. Verse 16 references them dividing the 300 men into three different companies of 100. Then verse 21 would reference every man standing in his place around the camp. All right, which we're all familiar with that. We're used to that. So then if we go into chapter 8, verse 10, we have where we get some numbers for these Midianites possibly. And it says, now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and those were the leaders of the army there. And their hosts with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of the host of the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword. So there's 15,000 men left, 120,000 already died, so that's a total of 135,000 men. All right, so now we're going to do a little bit of math with this and see maybe what it looked like. I'm going to go a really small area, I think, and we're just going to go 135,000 men times 45 square feet, which is simply 9 foot by 5 foot. So those of you that are familiar with construction, a 4x8 sheet of plywood, we're just going a foot longer and a foot wider. That's easily enough for a man to sleep in and to keep all his gear and things like that. It does not take into account camels, all right? And we also have walkways between tents and all those types of things. So I think this number is fairly conservative. So let's just roll with it for a little bit here. So if you go 45 square feet a man times 135,000 men, that's 140 acres. Our land here with the industrial park all around us right here, it would be about four times that big of area that it would take for this army to be camped, and that's not taking into account camels and things like that. Another easy way of thinking about it is if the camp would be exactly a mile long, it would be 1,150 feet wide, just a little bit less than a quarter mile wide. Okay? Now, just think about the amount of people here first. 135,000 men. I Googled Lucas Oil Stadium, home of the Indianapolis Colts. That holds 67,000 men, so right at half, almost exactly half. So you need to picture yourself and 299 other men standing at midfield, and that stadium being full of screaming men that have swords, and then take that times two, because there's twice that many. And you have to think that would look a little bit overwhelming. Yeah, there's no way you can write that off and say that was you doing that, because it is a lot of men. Now back to our camp here just a little bit with these 135,000 men. If we double that, just, I'm sorry, we'll go with the 45 square feet. If you do that mile long, 1,150 feet wide, and then you would surround that with 300 men equally spaced. Anyone want to guess how far apart they would be? Don't try to do the math, just guess. Anyone got a guess? I mean, I would have thought it was a lot. It's 42 feet apart between these men. If you would have asked me before I did the math and did all of that, if I knew the 135,000 men, I would have said that I would have been here and the next closest man was probably almost a speck on the horizon. Like, I just would have figured he'd have been way far away. Speck on the horizon is an exaggeration, but I would have thought he was a long ways away. Now, if we're saying, and I agree with this, that the 45 square feet is too small, if we would up that to 100 square feet per man to hopefully allow for the camel and the walk space and all that type of stuff, I assume these men had a tent and they packed, you know, 50 guys in a tent, and then there's walkways around that and stuff like that. There's some assuming here. But if you would assume that there's 100 square feet per man, realize that that does not double the distance, because the camp can still be exactly a mile long, and all you got to do is double the width, and it doubles the square footage, right? So then the distance between men would simply go from 42 feet between them to 52 feet. It doesn't actually go way higher. So I think it's actually somewhat reasonable to think that these men were somewhere between, and they obviously stood away from camp. I'm doing the perimeter right up tight against the camp. There's some things like that. I would think 70 to 80 feet is probably a fairly responsible number on how far apart these men could have been, which isn't as far as I would have thought. I believe this building is 82 feet wide. Is that right, Rod? How about that for being on the spot? Is that what it is? 87. 87. Okay. So you're not, you know, if one man's standing on the wall over here, out in the opening, not here, but it's not even all the way to the next wall. How far apart would that feel in the middle of the night when you're holding a torch and he's holding a torch over there by the doors to the restroom? Would it feel far apart? Yes. Would it feel like you are totally alone? I don't think so. in my opinion. I think it's interesting to think about it to me, and that in that situation where God asked them to step out in faith and God asked them to be obedient to him and do it this way, that they felt very vulnerable, obviously. They're outnumbered 400-1. They are surrounding the camp where if these men wake up and grab their swords, they're all going to be dead in a very short amount of time. So they feel very, very vulnerable, but I don't think they necessarily felt like they were the only man on that hillside. I think it's very, very interesting how we can see a little bit of God's heart there, maybe, in that it required them to be vulnerable, to step out, and yet they were not alone. They still had community. They still had these men close enough that they could see them and feel a part of a group. We may often feel vulnerable when we step out in faith and obey the Lord, but we are never isolated. It often feels like we are all on our own, and God sometimes does ask us to do specific things that are just us. But oftentimes, if we stop and look around, God has surrounded us with people from church, family, friends, that are much, much closer than we think. The devil often tries to tell us that we are the only ones, that we're alone, but don't listen to that. There are people that are carrying a torch, much like we are, that are much closer than we think. So, in conclusion, thinking back to the sacrifices that they did with the dedication of the temple, hopefully looking at that gave us a little bit different perspective on the importance of blood and what those people would have thought about the importance of blood in coming to the Lord and coming to his temple. And then thinking of the quail and Jesus feeding the 5,000, what is our attitude towards what God has provided? When God provides manna, are we satisfied with that, or do we insist on quail? Are there things in our life that God has given us hoping that we realize that is enough and that is more than we need, and that they will not bring fulfillment and satisfaction apart from God? And then lastly, with Gideon and his men, as we just talked about, God wants the glory in every situation, and when he calls us out in faith, it often makes us feel very vulnerable and very scared and afraid, but realize that there are others around us, very close to us, that are there to encourage us and to help us as well. So with those thoughts, let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this morning. I thank you for this time that we can look at your word, the different accounts that you give us, real life people that are just like us, that were serving you and doing the best that they could in the situations in which you placed them. I pray that our attitudes and our actions as we serve you and the different situations you put us would bring honor and glory to you. I pray that we would not be discouraged or ever think that we are alone, the only one facing a certain battle or a certain struggle, but that we would realize that you have placed people around us to encourage us, to go through that with us, and that are there to bless and encourage us as well. So pray that you would be with the many ministers as they travel back to their different congregations. Pray that you would be with the ministers from here in a special way, that they would be encouraged and blessed down there. Also be with the many youth that are going to EBI this next week. Just watch over them. Pray that they would grow in you. Have a good term down there as well. In Jesus' name, amen.